Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is one of Norway's most exciting up-and-coming travel writers. She studied social anthropology at the University of Oslo, a topic which has clearly influenced her considered observational style of writing. She's probably best known for her book The Year Without Summer, which details the awful time that followed the massacre on the Norwegian island of Utøya in 2011. She was named as one of the 10 new voices from Europe by Europe Literary Live in 2016. Alongside her writing, she's a polyglot, currently speaking 8 languages. Her latest book, The Border, a journey around Russia through North Korea, China, Mongolia, Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Ukraine, Belarus, Lithuania, Poland, Finland, Norway, and the Northeast Passage. Erika Fatland, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you.
I called you a travel writer. Is that strictly correct?
I'm not sure, but I haven't found a better term, actually. So I usually call myself a travel writer.
Well, I understand that you were absolutely entranced by maps as a small child. Tell me about your love of travel and where that came from.
Yeah, I come from a small village in the west of Norway. So at that time, no one traveled very much. And I remember looking at the maps we had at home and then later also at school. I went to the school in the 1990s, but still we had the old maps of the Soviet Union. And I remember looking at those maps and just being so fascinated just by the sheer size of the Soviet Union. And I never got tired of looking at those maps.
And was that something encouraged at home? Tell me about a little bit about your home life and your parents.
So I grew up on a farm, and my father and my father's family, they also ran the biggest private abattoir slaughterhouse in Norway. So when I was a teenager, I became a vegetarian, and I still am.
How did that go down with your parents?
Well, they hoped it would pass.
Erika, you speak 8 languages. Where did that originate from?
I've always loved languages. And then, well, as I said, I come from a small village, and being a child in that small village, that was full of freedom. Very nice childhood. But then being a teenager in that small village was more difficult, and I became very lonely. So I wanted to leave the village. And then there was a program for Norwegian girls and boys who wanted to take the whole gymnasium high school in France. So at the age of 16, I went to France and did 2 years of high school in France before going to Finland.
What did you do in Finland?
Then I took the last year of high school in Finland. I was supposed to do all 3 years in France, but I was very young and eager and not very patient. And I felt, well, 2 years in France, that must be enough. It's time to move on.
And you go to Finland and learn that language too?
No, luckily no. So Swedish is also one of the official languages of Finland. And I went to a Swedish-Finnish school. And Swedish is quite similar to Norwegian. So I could manage with Norwegian.
What other languages do you speak?
Well, I keep learning them and then forgetting them. So the languages I've learned would be Spanish, German, Russian. And then I've tried to learn Hindi and Arabic, but I wouldn't say I could speak them.
Incredibly useful, though. So, I mean, you really are a traveller who can get around on her own, and that's pretty much what you've been doing.
Yes, I've always loved travelling, but I didn't plan on becoming a travel writer. I wanted to be a writer my whole life, but I imagined myself writing deep novels. Then at the age of 19, I realised that I probably needed some education before becoming a writer. And that's when I started studying social anthropology. And that then brought me to Russia and the Caucasus, where I did my master thesis about the aftermath of the terrorist attack on school number 1 in Beslan in 2004. And that then became my first nonfiction book after writing the thesis.
Tell me about that, because you actually, you went there and you met the people and spoke to the families that had been affected by the Beslan terror attacks.
Yes. So what I asked myself was, how could people in Beslan, it's quite a small town, how could they manage to live on after this terrible tragedy? What happened after all the journalists went home? So I went there in 2007, 3 years after the terrorist attack. And most of the people I spoke to were still devastated. Many of the mothers would go to the cemetery every day, stay there for hours. I even met a father who lost his daughter, and he literally lived in the cemetery. They built a house for him so he could stay there all the time. So it was a very moving experience, obviously. And I was also very young. But the saddest thing was that, well, you say that tragedies would bring people together. It's what's usually being said. And what I found in Beslan is that that's not true at all. There were so many conflicts in Beslan. People turned against each other, blaming each other. So the teachers who had been with the pupils as hostages, they were then blamed. Well, why did you survive? Why didn't you manage to save more children? And then there was money because the victims got compensations, and then some got more than others, and people argued about that. So it was a very sad place.
Mm. As is Utøya. Now, that was the subject of your next book.
Yes. So I had worked on Beslan for many years, and the book was due to be published in August 2011 in Norwegian. And then in July, 22nd of July, we had a terrible terrorist attack in Norway, where Breivik first exploded a bomb in the city centre of Oslo, and then he went to the small island of Utøya, and he killed 69 young people who were there on a political youth camp. Norway is a small country, but since this was a political youth camp for the Labour Party, children and youth from all over Norway were gathered. So the whole of Norway was affected. This was also a personal book for me, because I didn't know, as this was happening, I did not know that my cousin Lars, he was at the island because he had just recently joined that youth party. And then my mother called me and she said, that, well, Lars is at the island, but he's fine. He has been rescued. And I was, of course, relieved to know that. And then a little later that evening, I got another call and my mom told me, well, it was another boy called Lars. So we don't know where our Lars is. And then we lived for a few hours without knowing anything about Lars and where he was, if he was still alive. And he was among the first who were shot by Breivik. And he managed to hide underneath a bush. And he was laying there. He was shot in his lungs, bleeding. And he was among the last who were rescued and brought to the hospital. And then the doctor said, had he been brought in half an hour later, he would not have survived. But he did, luckily.
And was able, I'm sure, then to share with you a really intimate account of the whole experience.
Yeah, he was among the many people that I interviewed about what had happened at Utøya. So for the next year, I interviewed survivors, but also people from the ambulances, the police, firemen, and of course also parents who had lost their children. So when I was writing the book about Beslan, I never imagined that I would write a similar book about my own country, but that's what happened.
And did you find that there was a similar effect, as there had been in Beslan, of conflict afterwards, of blame appropriation and so on in Norway?
Well, first you had the love and compassion. You had people marching in the streets of Oslo, carrying roses in their hands, talking about love and how the Norwegian society would never surrender to the terrorists and how this would bring about openness and so on. And that's for the first few weeks. And then slowly conflicts started emerging, like they did in Beslan. So especially the leader of the youth party, he was blamed for... he fled the island on a boat, and he was then blamed for why did he flee, why did he not fight, and so on. And of course, that is, I would say, not fair to demand of a man in his early 20s to fight an armed terrorist on his own. And then still now, there are a few conflicts in Norway. Now there is a conflict about the memorial and where it should be placed. And so we still don't have an official memorial at Utøya or close to Utøya. So because the neighbors have been protesting, because the neighbors were more involved than the police in saving the children who were fleeing and swimming in the lake. And now they are complaining that they don't want a memorial that they will see every day and be reminded of the trauma. So this memorial was just recently stopped by court, and we don't know what's happening.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's a country that's still traumatized by what happened.
Yeah, I would say that it's still too early to see the full consequences and aftermaths of what happened at Utøya, because many of these young people who were there were indeed very young, and many of them have continued with politics. So I'm sure that many of them will become professional politicians. And then, of course, this experience that they had at a very young age, surviving terrorism, will, of course, affect how they think and act as grown-up politicians.
Mm. Where is Breivik now?
He's in prison, and he will stay there for the rest of his life.
Let's talk about your next book, because this was an extraordinary journey through Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan and Uzbekistan. Firstly, wow, that's so ambitious. Tell me how that came about.
Well, I can't say exactly when I got the idea, but one day the title was in my head, Sovietistan, together with the title, actually the whole idea to write a book about those Central Asian countries ending with Stan, those countries that used to be part of the Soviet Union but had now at that time been independent for 25 years. And those countries were still to me like a big white dot on the map. I knew nothing about them. We hear very little about those countries. And I was very curious what came out on the other side after this experience of being part of the Soviet Union. What happened to those countries? What were they like today?
And what did you find?
Oh, I think many of the stories that I tell in that book, if a fiction writer had written it, you would say that's so unrealistic, that can't be true. And that especially goes for Turkmenistan, which is a very strange country, I would say. People say it's the North Korea of Central Asia, but I would say there is only one Turkmenistan. And it was ruled by a very eccentric dictator. Well, actually, he was the leader of the Communist Party in Turkmenistan until 1991. And he had never sought for independence. None of the Central Asian countries had. And then suddenly in 1991, they were independent countries as the Soviet Union broke apart. And in Turkmenistan, they solved that very practically. So the leader of the Communist Party, he just changed his job title and he became president. And then the Communist Party changed the name and became the Democratic Party. No one in Moscow could control this man anymore. Sapar Murat Niyazov was his name, but he very soon took another title, started calling himself Turkmenbashi, which means the father of all Turkmen. And then he started building golden statues of himself, and he became more and more eccentric, I would say, and his ego grew bigger and bigger. So he changed the names of the days and months, naming one month after himself, another after his mother, and so on.
He's not still in power.
No, he died to his own surprise in 2007, because just before he died, he had told his poor Turkmen people that he would continue to live for at least another 20 years, and he did not. So he died, and then his dentist became president. So that's a very interesting career.
Extraordinary. Right, now we come to your new book, The Border. Tell me what the idea was here, because you're going around Russia, but you don't actually go into Russia.
No, actually, the idea of The Border came to me in a dream. I was writing Sovietistan and I was thinking about what should I do next, because I don't have a job, so I need to have good ideas. And then one night I dreamt I was walking on a big map and I was walking from one country to the next, but north of the red line the same country was lying there all the time, and that was Russia. So when I woke up, I had a title, I had the entire idea to travel around the biggest country in the world and to try to find out, what does it mean to have Russia as a neighbor? How does that affect you? And of course, I found, I must say modestly, that I found the idea very good. And then I thought, well, this idea is so good, so this book must already exist. So the first thing I did was to check on Amazon if there was a book or how many books like this already existed. And to my joy, no one had written that book before. And then when I started doing my research, it dawned upon me why no one had bothered to do that trip before.
Because it was so difficult.
It was difficult and very, very long. I mean, we're talking about the biggest country in the world, so obviously also the longest border. And as I traveled through 14 countries, starting in North Korea, ending in the north of Norway. So it's also quite fascinating that between Norway and North Korea, there is only one country.
That's extraordinary. Tell me about North Korea. How difficult was it to access it?
I would say it's both quite easy and it was quite difficult. If you go there as a tourist, it's very easy. And that's what I did. So I joined a tourist group that would travel not only in Pyongyang and the capital, but also visit the north and the border area. But then I think North Korea is the only country, or the embassy of North Korea is the only embassy that asks proof of where you are working. So I actually had to give them a certificate from my employer to get a visa. And of course, I could not tell them I was writing a book. So I had to become creative. And then, as I told you, my father is running a slaughterhouse. So finally, this came in handy. And I called to the office and I asked, could you please give me a certificate that I'm working for you? So I get a certificate. And that was the perfect alibi. No one would ask me anything about my job. And I got the visa to enter North Korea.
And did you get access to ordinary people there at all?
No, not at all, because you are, when you travel in North Korea, you are very protected against the people of North Korea. So you travel with two guides all the time because the guides are, of course, reporting on each other. And the closest we would get to ordinary people, we were allowed to travel on the metro for a few stations, and then I would stand close to other people and they were staring at us, obviously, but we could not talk to them. They could not talk to us. That would have been dangerous for them. It's a very, very controlled society and it's a very closed society. That's what's so fascinating, because I mean, I've traveled in authoritarian states before, like Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan, but North Korea is so closed off. They don't have internet. They don't have international TV. So most of North Koreans know nothing, or very, very little, about the world outside of North Korea. So we were allowed in the north, we were actually allowed to visit a school for gifted children. And then we were given one student each to have a conversation with. Of course, the teacher was walking around with his ears, listening to what we were saying. But I was given then a 15-year-old. His English was very good. And so I asked him, well, what would you want to do with your life? Maybe do you want to travel? And the answer I got was, no, why should I travel? North Korea is the best country in the world. And I also asked him, so what do you want to do when you grow up? And I was expecting him to say, maybe I want to become a teacher or a doctor, because obviously he was a gifted and bright young boy. And the answer I got was, I want to join the army. And then I asked, well, why do you want to join the army? And joining the army in North Korea, that means at least 10 years of military service. And then he went to his teacher and he came back and he said, to serve my country. Mm.
This journey was 20,000 kilometres. And I mean, you met some extraordinary people. And that's really what's at the heart of this book, is these personal interactions with the people that you meet, survivors of wars, people who have gone through an extraordinary time. And I just wonder how you saw that sort of cultural journey unfold as you moved from country to country.
Well, there was a big shift when I entered Kazakhstan, because then I was in former Soviet territory and I would remain in former Soviet territory until Estonia. So then I could usually manage with speaking Russian to people, and the architecture and everything would be similar. What fascinated me also so much along this journey was the act of crossing borders, because we don't do that so much anymore in our society. Like in Europe, you don't notice when you're crossing a border. And if we go further, we usually go by plane. But crossing a physical border is extremely fascinating, because the physical move, the trip is very small, it's very short, a few hundred meters, maybe a few kilometers. So the landscape around you remains the same, but then everything else suddenly changes. The people's faces, the way people look, the language, the alphabet, the money people use, their references. Suddenly you're just in another world and you have moved a few hundred meters.
In Ukraine, you met a professor who was now a tank driver.
Yes, I got the idea of traveling around Russia in 2014 in the winter. And then a few weeks later, Russia annexed Crimea. And then a few weeks after that, the war broke out in eastern Ukraine. So my journey around the border became more dramatic than I had imagined at first. Suddenly, the border was moving again. So I'm not a war correspondent, so I was quite nervous about going to Donetsk. It was still a war then. There is still a war today. It was a strange place to visit, actually, because crossing the border, we would hear weapons being fired. It was very dangerous to go out of the car. It was also very difficult to get all the documents to enter. And then we would drive past villages where houses had burned down. You could see physical traces of the war everywhere. And then we entered the capital, Donetsk, which used to be one of the richest cities in Ukraine, and everything just seemed so normal. People were going to restaurants, dancing. Only way you could notice that nothing was normal was that there were very few cars in the streets, because so many people had already fled. And at 10 o'clock, everything was quiet because there was a curfew. And then there would be tape on the windows in case of explosions. Otherwise, everything was normal.
Mm. And the tank driver?
And the tank driver, I was invited to visit a school for teenagers actually learning the art of war. And one morning they were having an exercise outdoors and I was invited to come. And then Vladimir, the former professor of history, would take me there. And, well, he was quite a character. It's almost difficult to describe him. He was very manly, very macho, very proud to have a second wife, much younger than himself. And then, like so many of the soldiers I met in Ukraine, he would talk nonstop about homosexual people, and they were very proud that there were no homosexual people left in Donetsk, or so they claimed. So for me, I always try to ask open questions. I never try to enter a debate with the people I meet, because my job is not to change their meanings. I just want to understand why they think the way they do. Mm. But with Vladimir, that was a challenge.
One of the places you went to was Chernobyl. Can you describe that?
Yeah, so Chernobyl is obviously also a very strange place. And I think the most strange thing is that you can go there on an organized trip, like you would go to Versailles. Chernobyl is also becoming a tourist attraction. And I believe after the HBO series, now there are even more tourists visiting every year. So I went on this organized trip with a guide, making those kind of jokes that the guide will make, like, so yeah, we expect that 10% of you will not come back. There is always some collateral damage and so on. But there are still a few old people living in Chernobyl. They went back in the 90s and refused to leave their homes. So I met a couple of those old people who went back to live there. And there was one village where only There was an old couple living there, and then a few houses away, there was an old woman living by herself. And the sad thing was that these two or three people hated each other and blamed each other for stealing from their houses. So they were just three people in the village, and they wouldn't talk to each other.
Finally, you came back to your own country. How did you see it?
Yes, so Norway has 196 kilometer long border with Russia. So I decided to follow that border meter by meter. So first I went kayaking with my father up the border river, and then we went by foot to the very end till we met the ocean. So that was also interesting because on the Norwegian side of the border, there are houses, there are people, you can move freely till the borderline. If you cross the borderline, you will be in trouble. Mm. And then on the Russian side, there was nothing because they have this border zone of a few kilometers where you're not allowed to enter. So you had this contrast, which I think is also quite telling of the differences between Norway and Russia. But of the 14 neighboring countries of Russia, Norway is the only country that has never been at war with Russia and it has never been occupied by Russia. On the contrary, in 1944, the Red Army freed the north of Norway from the Germans. So actually, I think Norway would be one of the countries that historically has the best relationship with Russia.
Mm. Erica, one last question. Did you do this journey all in one go, or did you have to sort of break it up over a long period of time?
Well, initially, my goal was to do it in one trip, and then I found out that was quite unrealistic. So I did two long trips, first from North Korea to Nagorno-Karabakh, where there is now, sadly, a war raging, and then from Georgia to the Norwegian-Finnish-Russian border. Then I did a trip along the Norwegian border a few months later when the climate was better. And then finally, and that was the most difficult part of the whole journey, that was a trip through the Northeast Passage. And for a long time, I thought that I wouldn't make that. But I found at the last minute a tourist boat, a small tourist boat that would take me through the Northeast Passage. That was in August 2017. And the book was published in Norwegian in October the same year.
Wow. And one thing that you noticed on that boat was the extreme age of the other passengers.
Yes, of course, I was curious about the other passengers. Who would they be? Because it was, I would say, it was not a cheap trip. It was extremely expensive. And I was going to write a book. But who were the others? Who would pay $20,000 to stay 4 weeks on a boat? And it was not a luxury boat. It was a shared cabin, toilets in the hallway, no casino or nothing like that. And our only entertainment were desolated, isolated islands where the only inhabitants would be polar bears. It was, for me, maybe the most interesting part of the journey because it was the part that I could not imagine beforehand because I had never been to the Arctic before. And it was also, I would say, a very nostalgic journey because we were traveling through a landscape that is disappearing. The global warming is happening much faster in the Arctic than in the rest of the world. So we encountered very little ice, and that ice is melting very fast. Mm. So in a few years, there will be no ice in the summer in the Arctic.
Erica, one personal question I have to ask you. What's your top packing tip?
I'm lousy at packing. I pack too much always. So my trick is that I bring a suitcase or a backpack that is not too big so that it's physically impossible to bring too many things.
Erica, thank you so much for speaking to me.
Thank you.
That's Erica Fatland, and her book The Border is out now. It's translated by Kari Dixon and it's published by Maclehurst Press. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Nora Hull, Louis Allen and Charlie Filmer-Court. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.